I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Our conversation today is about Iraq. Who's in charge? And what happens now after a Shia cleric, not the prime minister, gets radical militias to stand down? But first, Congress is back in Washington from a two-week break that saw that uptick of violence in Iraq and a worsening economy. Today, Senate Banking Committee Chair Christopher Dodd said there are 8,000 home foreclosures a day, the same rate as during the Great Depression. This morning, the Commerce Department reported that overall construction spending in February fell for the fifth straight month, and gas prices hit a new record high of $3.29 a gallon yesterday. So what is Congress willing or able to do about it all? Joining us from Capitol Hill, Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Gail, you write today about a disconnect between Congress and the Bush administration over what to do about the credit crisis. Let's start there. Tell us more about that disconnect.
Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson gave a much-leaked and long-awaited presentation yesterday about a blueprint for overhauling federal regulation of the financial services industries. But for Congress, in giving this presentation, he said, look, this is long-term. You know, we're not going to get this done for many years, and especially, he said, we're not going to do it as long as the current market tension persists. Now, for Congress, the time frame is precisely the opposite. They're coming back from 2 weeks, many with their constituents in their states and districts, hearing of the pain of this housing crisis and needing to show very quickly that they can take hold and do something decisive. So it's a real conflict of time frame starting out.
Well, it sounds as if some of the members of Congress want more immediate action. And we mentioned Christopher Dodd. He called the Paulson plan a wild pitch. The Consumer Federation of America, we reported on their response yesterday. They were disdainful of this long-term plan. They said it's like telling Hurricane Katrina victims to hold onto their roofs while Washington restructures FEMA.
That's right.
So obviously there's not a, you know, there's not a big embrace between Congress and the Bush administration as they come back. But what can Congress do? Because past plans have been turned down.
Well, you know, despite the sort of war of words, there is actually underneath a lot of consensus in the sense that Democrats would just as soon wait to do a massive regulation of financial services with their own president and a new Congress with more Democrats, they expect, than now. And in a sense, they've put a lot on the back burner, including much of the Iraq War, because of the current balance of power in the Senate. They don't have enough to overcome a presidential veto, and President Bush still in the White House. But in the short term, you're going to see two things. As early as today, this afternoon actually, the Senate is taking up another run at a housing bill that Democrats have proposed that would provide about $4 billion in community development block grants, and a controversial provision that would allow bankruptcy judges to, in effect, reconstruct home mortgages. A business community calls this the cram down. They're very opposed to it.
Well, and I just want to mention that just last month, Republicans blocked a measure to earmark, you know, billions of dollars for communities to buy and rehabilitate foreclosed homes.
Same measure.
And they were also, yeah, and they were also against that plan to allow bankruptcy judges to soften the terms of mortgages. So what's
happened?
The
difference is 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Democrats feel that the Republicans have heard from their constituents that they are very upset, that they do not want to see, as you say, putting this off indefinitely. They want to see something now.
Well, and you say this has also had an impact on another topic, which is food prices, that Republicans are hearing some noise about that at home as well.
Exactly. Both, you know, we've spoken about gasoline prices. Food prices are the latest. Cost of flour tripling, not just here, but overseas as well. That's going to have two impacts. There is a farm bill that's been percolating through the system that the ag chairman have been very eager to get out this or next week. But the problem is that members are coming back hearing, you know, why should we be subsidizing farmers at a time when commodity prices are so high? So yeah, I think you're going to see a lot more pushback on that plan than might otherwise have been the case. And even some talk, I don't know how far this can go this session, of revisiting the ethanol provisions that were in the last energy bill, because that has diverted a lot of farm production, corn especially, into fuels instead of food, increasing those prices.
Right. Well, we'll see. We'll pay attention in the next couple of months, and with your help, Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, thank you.
You're welcome.
Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki today declared that his government's military operation to clear the southern town of Basra of Shiite militia violence was a success. This despite the fact that it was radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr who got the militias to clear the streets, not the government troops or police. So, who is in charge in Iraq, and what happens now? Well, first we turn to Vali Nasser. He's professor of international politics at Tufts, Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. His latest book is The Shia Revival, How Conflicts with Islam Will Shape the Future. And Vali, we have Shia interaction here in Iraq. Is it clear at this point who's in charge there?
Well, we know that Prime Minister Maliki is in charge of the Iraqi government in the Green Zone, but in the south, it's not very clear who's in charge, in particular because the governorates and a lot of municipal authorities are in the hands of the backer of Mr. Maliki, the ISKI party. But the streets are, in many places, including in Basra, are controlled by Muqtada al-Sadr's militiamen.
Well, help us understand this, because Muqtada al-Sadr was credited with bringing down the violence during the recent surge in U.S. troops by ordering a ceasefire. Last week, the Prime Minister Maliki said his Iraqi troops were targeting criminal elements in Basra, but there are many different Shia militias there. Was he seen as targeting just Sadr's followers?
Yes, although there are many other militias there, and some of them are far more powerful, more criminal, and much more important to Basra, the operation was by and large directed at the Mahdi army and at Muqtada al-Sadr's forces. So in many ways, it was Mr. Maliki and his backers who broke the truce and the ceasefire that had been negotiated earlier between the various Shia factions.
And why would they do that?
I think they assumed that this was the time to do it. There was an assumption that by leaving for Iran and accepting the ceasefire, Muqtada al-Sadr had been weakened. And also, Mr. Maliki and his main Shia backer, the ISKI party of Abdulaziz Hakim, who is backed by the United States, are looking to consolidate their power in upcoming elections, tentatively scheduled for the fall. So they calculated this was the time to take Muqtada al-Sadr down and take control of Basra.
To weaken him ahead of those elections. Well, you've said a lot here. First of all, it has been reported, although he's denied it, that Muqtada al-Sadr has been studying in Iran to achieve a higher level as a religious leader. It's confusing because we also hear that he's being viewed differently by Americans, that he was once called the most dangerous man in Iraq. Remember, that was a cover of Newsweek. And now we understand that U.S. military officials are addressing Muqtada al-Sadr as His Excellency Muqtada when they speak on Iraqi television. So why would Maliki want to take down Sadr, who U.S. officials seem to be viewing as more of a responsible force?
Well, I think that there is not as much difference between where Mr. Maliki and the U.S. military is. The U.S. military may be forced to address Mr. Sadr with some degree of respect, but that does not mean that the U.S. military would want Sadr to take over southern Iraq. Hmm. I think there was hope that Mr. Maliki and his ally, Mr. Hakim, would be able to win this fight and downgrade Mr. Sadr.
Boy, would you and other observers see that as a terrible miscalculation?
Yes, it was a terrible miscalculation because now Mr. Sadr is actually stronger than before Basra happened. The momentum is with him and the wind is in his sails.
And meantime, Basra, by all accounts, has become, according to one article I was reading, a cesspool of crime. Women there beheaded for simply wearing nail polish. And it sounds as if, from what I just heard from you, that it might have been even other militias who were doing that.
Well, Basra is a combination of criminality and lawlessness, and then some groups that are absurdly fanatical. And all of them are vying for control of the city, which is the largest Shia city of the south and the gateway to the Gulf and where most of the oil revenue of Iraq comes from. And so far, no single militia has been able to dominate it. So it's still the biggest prize standing out there between Mr. Hakim and Mr. Sadr over who will control it. And in many ways, it is a problem. Basra is a problem, but the way in which Mr. Maliki tried to solve it had little to do with law and order in Basra and everything to do with settling his own competition with Mr. Sadr for power.
And meantime, the violence in Basra goes on. Seem to have been untouched, at least the violence from by the militias against some of the citizens that we heard about, even though other followers of Sadr have cleared the streets. What do you think the political future of the Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, is at this point?
Well, Mr. Maliki is a weak prime minister. He's by and large the mayor of the green zone. And in some ways, he's there because there's no easy way of finding a substitute for him. But the real issue in the south is not Mr. Maliki. The real fight is between Mr. Sadr and Mr. Hakim, who is now Mr. Maliki's biggest backer in the parliament as well. So Mr. Maliki may fall as the fall guy for this wrong operation, but that's not going to change the calculus of power in Iraq and the weakness of the central government anytime soon.
We're going to hear more about how this intra-fighting between Shia is going to continue to be a problem. But in the meantime, you know, what do you see as, endgame is the wrong word, but where do you see this going? I'm reading in Spiegel Online a Berhard Sands article where he says, you know, what Basra, you know, possibly means is a war that draws Turkey in the north in and maybe Iran in fighting over these valuable oil resources in Basra.
Well, the Turkish involvement in Iraq has to do with other things than the South. But I think what it really means is that if the United States thought there was an easy way to use the surge to bring stability to southern Iraq, that has now disappeared. That we now realize that southern Iraq can actually be the Achilles heel of Iraq, far more dangerous than western Iraq. And the United States does not have a solution as to how to deal with the Shia fighting and with Mr. Sadr. And that we've also found out over the weekend that Iran plays a far more important role than we were willing to admit. After all the deals were broken in Tehran to end the fighting.
Tell us more about that in the minute or so we have. The negotiations took place in Tehran.
Yes, there's a delegation that was sent by Mr. Maliki to go visit Mr. Sadr in Iran. And ultimately, everybody in this fight has close ties with Iran, and Iran hosted the negotiation and probably encouraged the ceasefire that ultimately took place. So the Iranians played a very big role in ending this conflict.
So in the meantime, Vali Nasr, how do you see, you know, elections are scheduled, they may be canceled at this point. Do you see this as just uneasy truce on the streets?
It is uneasy truce, and I'll be very skeptical if elections go forward, because I think if the elections were held now, Sadr would sweep them, and that will not benefit the United States. U.S. was hoping that the elections would confirm Mr. Hakim and his party as the government of the southern Iraq. So I don't see an easy way that the United States is going to get the kind of order that it wants in southern Iraq with the current strategy it has. It has to now go back to the drawing board and think through how it's going to bring stability to the south.
Vali Nasr, professor of international politics at Tufts University's Fletcher School. His latest book is The Shia Revival, How Conflicts Within Islam Will Shape the Future. As we're hearing, they are shaping the future of Iraq. Professor Nasr, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And just ahead, General Barry McCaffrey on the situation in Iraq and how there's many more than just two sides, as we were just hearing. Later in the program, if you're noticing some trucks stopped longer than they normally are at truck stops, it could be because they're fed up with high fuel prices. We'll hear about the truckers' shutdown. Back in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, back with more about the internal political divisions in Iraq. We've just heard about them, and now we wonder, how does that affect the American military strategy going forward? Well, today, Britain announced that it will postpone a planned pullout of 1,500 troops from Iraq. That will leave the 4,000 British troops in the southern Iraqi city of Basra intact. We're joined now by General Barry McCaffrey. He's adjunct professor of international affairs at West Point and a commentator for NBC News. And General McCaffrey, we've been asking in the last month, is the surge working? You know, with the president and John McCain saying that it is. We had military analyst Andrew Bacevich telling us it's not. At most, it's produced a sort of a draw. And then the events of the past week indicate that it's maybe not even a draw. But is the surge working? Maybe the wrong question. Is there another question we should be asking?
Robin, you are directly on the point. The surge was militarily and politically, from a U.S. perspective, not sustainable. We put five brigades additional into Iraq. They went into the cities. We knew we couldn't keep them there much beyond essentially a six-month temporary surge of forces. I think what was new, I might add, is this brilliant General Petraeus's tactics change. He put 72 security stations around Baghdad. He, you know, started to concern local citizens. So there were a lot of tactical things. And also al-Qaeda in Iraq, the Sunni insurgents, changed their tune. But I didn't think the surge of forces was instrumental, central to what temporarily was a better situation. It was internal dynamics of Iraq's political life. These guys basically are in a civil war. It's low grade now. They're waiting for U.S. withdrawal to settle the issue, and that doesn't necessarily imply that it'll only going to be settled through military power. That's likely, but not necessarily what's going to happen. And by the way, we get the Iranians. They are obviously actively supporting many of these Shiite factions. It's a cauldron. It's chaotic. We ought to be concerned.
Well, you mentioned Iran. We've talked to analysts who said that the U.S. should actually be talking to Iran because Iran has so much influence in Iraq.
Oh, sure. We've got to talk to the Iranians. There's no question. They're going to play, and it's logical, they would want to play an instrumental role in ensuring that the 60% of the population that's Shiite doesn't end up in bondage and slavery again to a Sunni minority. I think to Dr. Rice's credit, she has opened this dialogue using our ambassador, Ryan Crocker, as the vehicle. And I think the Saudis now are playing a fairly positive role to try and defuse the six regional neighbors from stirring the pot in Iraq.
When you say Iraq is on the brink of a full-out civil war, I just want to be clear. Are you talking about between Shias? Because in this case, we have Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shia cleric, facing off with the Shia prime minister, al-Maliki. Some would interpret the past week as al-Maliki losing in that face-off. Are you talking about an intra-Shia civil war?
Well, of course, nothing's like, you know, the American Civil War, blue versus gray. In this case, there's no accepted national leadership inside the Sunni movement. There's no accepted national leadership inside the Shia movement with breakaway factions, criminal thugs, the Badr Brigade, the Sadr militias, etc. There's not necessarily even a unified political military presence in the Kurdish north either. They've had at each other over the last 25 years. The largest civil war that is being fought is a struggle between Shia to not end up again in bondage to the Sunni minority. But in addition, out there are the internal struggles for power, and looming in the distant horizon, the fight between Iraqi Arabs and the Kurdish North over oil and land. These guys are saying when the Americans withdraw, and Robin, we're coming out of Iraq in the next 2-3 years, largely, unless these people get their act together. When we withdraw, these folks are going to have to settle this argument, hopefully through political dialogue and compromise, and if not, through armed struggle.
Well, when you say there's no comparison to the blue and gray of the American Civil War, we've been thinking recently, after, you know, reading a lot of post-Civil War books, including The Bloody Shirt, about setbacks after the war, another Slavery by Another Name, just terrific books. But it's just a reminder that it took, you know, well over 100 years for the actual results of the Civil War to really be played out. I mean, is that a comparison in Iraq, that Americans just have to understand that it might take decades for this
sure.
to be...
Oh, sure. No question. I mean, there's been so much bloodshed in Iraq. You know, we think Saddam murdered a million people dominating this country, and he got them in a seven-year war with the Iranians. He crushed the Kurdish north. So the amount of bloodshed and hatred is just beyond belief. Now there are no institutions of government that work well except the emerging Iraqi army. So, you know, looking toward the future, and the American Civil War, you're quite right, it was 100 years of violence and hatred that followed the struggle essentially to free slaves. But at least that one, there were two sides to the war. In Iraq, there won't be two sides. There'll be the struggle for leadership inside the factions. The six neighbors may or may not play a positive role for Iraq, and then you've got the Shiite versus Sunni versus Kurdish confrontation.
And General McCaffrey, you're sure that all U.S. troops are going to be out in a few years?
Oh, no. I think if the Iraqis pull their act together, achieve some stable government, it might well be that we'd be there with a modest presence, 20, 30, 40,000 troops for as stability factor for logistical support. But what I don't think we'll do is continue trying to tamp down a low-grade civil war at $12 billion a month with a loss rate of 100 to 1,000 soldiers and Marines a month. That politically won't be acceptable to the American people. And by the way, the Army and Marine Corps and Special Operations troops and C-130 squadrons of the Air Force are really starting to unravel. They're too small to sustain this kind of national security strategy.
General Barry McCaffrey, adjunct professor of international affairs at West Point and a commentator for NBC News. General McCaffrey, thanks as always.
Good to be with you, Robin.
And by the way, what you just heard, lawmakers will be hearing tomorrow. General McCaffrey will be testifying before a Senate Foreign Relations Committee about military prospects in Iraq tomorrow. We'll be back with much more after the news, here and now. The government begins taking applications today in its annual lottery of H-1B visas. That program allows 65,000 foreigners to work on a short-term basis in the U.S. for high-tech companies. Last year, so many U.S. companies applied that the government stopped taking applications after just one day. High-tech company leaders like Bill Gates of Microsoft have called on Congress to increase the number of visas, saying that when American companies can't hire foreign workers to come to the U.S., they're forced to export those jobs overseas. Well, critics say high-tech companies could find those workers here, but meanwhile, the controversy over another visa program, the H-2B visa, is having a dramatic impact on seasonal companies. Congress failed to extend thousands of those visas last year, leaving ski resorts, landscaping companies, hotels, seafood packing plants, and even circuses scrambling for staff this year. James Judkins is the owner and founder of Circus Chimera in Hugo, Oklahoma. He relies on temporary workers from Mexico to fill his staff. He also hires temporary workers for other circuses across the country. James, Chimera was scheduled to open in February. Did you?
No, we didn't open. We had to cancel our season because we couldn't get any of our workers.
Well, explain how we got here. Your workers fall under this non-agricultural, seasonal, and temporary worker category. We know the cap for visas for these workers in the U.S. is 66,000. That's less than the number that has traditionally come to the U.S. So what happened in the past?
Well, in the past, there was an exemption to the law called the return worker exemption that said that if a worker had come into the United States, done the job they were supposed to do, paid their taxes, followed the law, done everything they were supposed to do, they wouldn't count against that 66,000 cap.
They were termed returning workers.
They were termed returning workers.
Right. And so your visa applications went under that extension?
Well, because that return worker exemption was not extended by Congress, the number of visas were used up immediately this year. The fiscal year for the federal government starts October 1st, and by September 27th, the first allotment of visas, the first 33,000, were gone.
Well, and obviously you didn't make that cut with your workers. What kind of work, by the way, did your temporary workers do? We should say you're a non-animal circus?
Yeah, we're a non-animal circus. Basically, it was setting up the tent, the seats, lighting, moving the show. We move three times a week, three different towns a week, so it involves a lot of tear down and set up and establishing the circus equipment, and that's basically what they did.
Well, we understand not renewing the extensions and these visas isn't just affecting your circus. As we said, you're an agent. You hire these workers for 100 other circuses and carnivals across the country. You normally hire, we understand, more than 3,000 each season. What's happening to those shows?
Well, basically, we've only been approved for about half of the number of visas we need for the year, and there are no more visas left. So some of the shows are contemplating cutting down, closing, and they're just struggling to find competent help to travel with the shows. The problem with a traveling show is, first, it's hard to find U.S. workers that want to live that lifestyle, that want to move from town to town to town and live at fairgrounds or empty lots for 9 months out of the year. And the second thing is that most of the carnivals and circuses have been upgrading their image and upgrading their workforce for safety reasons. And they've had to make sure that all of their workers are drug-free. They all have to be checked to make sure they don't have a criminal background, that they're all legal, that everything's 100% correct on them. So you've got two forces going. The shows are trying to upgrade their workforce. They found H-2B workers as a solution, and now all of a sudden they can't get those H-2B workers.
Well, you know, James, every time we cover the story of these H-2B visas, we hear from non-immigrant American workers who say, you know, whether it's hotel workers in South Carolina or on Martha's Vineyard, if you paid more, you wouldn't have to depend on the foreign workers.
It would be nice if we could pay more. The starting wage is about $300 a week, and I had people working up $600-$700 a week, and the business was basically operating at a break-even point. If I had been able to pay more, I'd love to pay more, but I can't.
Well, and you do pay workers the prevailing wage, the wage set by the Department of Labor?
Right. Well, what we have to do, because we're a traveling show, no matter where you travel in the country, you have to pay the highest prevailing wage for any point on your route. So if I start in Texas and the prevailing wage is $7 an hour, and then I pass through San Francisco, California, and the prevailing wage there is $11 or $12 an hour, I have to pay the highest prevailing wage for the entire season.
Well, meantime, there's some irony here because now nobody's working because the circus wasn't able to open, either American workers here or the foreign workers. Mm-hmm. What are both workers doing?
Well, basically, I had to lay off my U.S. staff, and then the foreign workers, it's hard for them to understand because, like when I've talked to them, I've gone down to visit and tell them, well, maybe we can get something resolved a little later in the year. Maybe we can get something done. They're saying, well, we did everything right. We did it legal. We didn't go in the country illegally. We didn't break the law. We paid all of our taxes. What's happening to us? Why can't we go back? They just can't understand the fact that they did it right, and now they feel like they're being punished, and all these other people are here illegally, and they just continue on their merry way. Most of them, they're earning 25% of what they'd be earning in the United States, and it's really hard for them to take care of their families.
Plus, as we said, on this side of the border, there are American workers who aren't working at all.
Right.
Because they had to be laid off. Well, I know you are one of those who's been trying to lobby Congress on this. You've gone to Washington how many times?
I've been four times.
And who do you talk to, and what do they say to you?
What's really strange is that every single congressional office and senatorial office that we've gone into says the H-2B program is a good program. They support it. It should be expanded. But because of the political climate and because of blocking by the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, the bill isn't going anywhere, to the return worker exemption.
Well, the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, these are the Hispanic Democrats in Congress. They say that they are blocking this because they want comprehensive legislation. They feel they have to have some leverage in order to get what they want, which is what they see as the greater good of comprehensive reform.
Whether we agree with comprehensive immigration reform or not, to me it doesn't seem logical that you'd make thousands and thousands of businesses and thousands of workers suffer for, quote, the greater good. The way it should be done is a step-by-step approach. You take the H-2B program as a workable solution. You use it as a model to advance a guest worker program that works. Show that the H-2B program works. Expand it. Instead of being temporary visas, make them a two-year visa or a three-year visa. And then you've got a basis to start working to allow illegal aliens a process for leaving the country, getting a visa, coming back with employment, and doing it right. And you'd think that that would be a logical way to solve things instead of all-or-nothing approach to immigration reform and making those that have followed the law suffer.
That's James Judkins of Circus Chimera in Hugo, Oklahoma. He says his circus had to shut down this season because Congress didn't extend a number of H-2B visas that seasonal workers used to come into the country. And by the way, we called the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. They sent us a statement saying that while the caucus very much supports H-2B visas, they say the program must be coupled with comprehensive immigration reform that unifies families and meets gaps in the labor force. Okay, before we go today, we're going to take a look at what looks like Boy Scout badges, but they're actually patches about the Pentagon's secret projects. You're listening to Here and Now. If it seems to you that there are fewer truckers on the roads today, there's a reason. A number of the country's 500,000 independent truckers are on a full or partial work stoppage to protest the cost of diesel fuel, which is up about 45% in the last year. Joining us first is Dan Little. He's the owner-operator of Little & Little Trucking in Carrollton, Missouri. And Dan, we understand you started this. You posted a notice on your website, uscattlehaulers.com, saying you wanted this protest. What happened after that?
Within 72 hours, I had 400 trucking companies had contacted me and had agreed to that this was a way to send a peaceful message to Washington to get their attention.
Well, it's hard to quantify how many trucks are doing this today, but we understand you had almost 1,000 emails yesterday alone. Tell us what some of them are saying.
All right, let me just click one. Here's one that just come in from Julie Adams. I would like to say that I support the shutdown 100%, and I'm glad that someone has the courage to stand up for what is right. I hope that the shutdown will help get fuel prices under control. Thanks and good luck, Julie. Here's the next one. Barbara Shan, 2 at AOL. I have two flatbed rigs. We went out on our own in November. I've been trucking for about 50 years and went through the strike in the 70s and survived. Both of my trucks are shutting down on April 1st.
We know you've had emails from across the country. Just remind us, I mean, it used to be the diesel fuel, which is less processed than, gas for cars, used to be cheaper than cars. Now it's more expensive?
On an average of about 60 cents a gallon more expensive.
What do you hope to achieve by the protest? I mean, what can Washington do?
We're hoping to get their attention so that they'll take a realistic look at this industry as a whole. We're losing 2,500 owner-operators a week, and that figures from 2 years ago. Truck repossessions in the last 30 to 60 days are up 130%, 120% in some areas.
In the meantime, you want Washington to temporarily suspend state and federal highway taxes. You say that would take maybe upwards of 60 cents off the price of fuel.
In some areas, it would take close to 60 cents, in some areas, 40 cents. But that would allow these owner-operators a chance to go back to running in the black for a time being and allow them a chance to look at their business plan. But it would also give Washington time to look at this industry as a whole and to figure out a reasonable solution to these problems, why we're losing all these guys. These are professional. These are not just guys that just jump in a truck and drive down the road. These guys have $100,000, $200,000, $250,000 invested in their equipment. And they're to the point now where they're not only losing their equipment, they're losing their homes and everything else.
Well, let's talk to one of these guys who's actually a gal, Sheila Walker, who's a lumber trucker from Georgia. And Sheila, we understand you are right at this moment leading a convoy up Interstate 75 to Atlanta to draw attention to diesel prices. Is this all resonating with you? Are you losing money?
I am. I have had several weeks in the past 3 months that my fuel bill has been more than my check. I can't make it like that.
Can you give us an example of some of the paycheck inequities in the last few months?
Well, let's see. My diesel fuel bill last week was like $1,579, somewhere in that neighborhood, and my check was only $14.
Well, how would you suggest that this be corrected?
Well, I think to start with, diesel fuel is a trash byproduct off of gasoline. It should be lower than gasoline to begin with. But then the mills that we haul our freight into are going to have to pay more money for us to haul that same freight. We've been making the same thing for years, and the prices just keep going up for the fuel. And we can't, it's got to be even compensation somewhere to keep going.
Do you ever consider, Sheila, giving up your rig?
No. I was born and raised in this stuff. It's all I've ever known how to do.
Dan, do you think it's going to make a difference?
Well, I hope and pray it does, because this is not just to benefit the owner-operators and independents. This is to benefit everybody in the United States today. If the government will get off their tails and get this industry leveled out, the economy will follow suit. It always has. This country rolls on the back of trucks. Billy Dalton, a Nashville recording artist, released a song, and it's playing on my website right now just on account of this movement. Now, when Nashville recording artists start looking at it, then you know there's something to it.
Well, that's Dan Little. We also spoke to Sheila Walker. They're independent truckers not working today to protest the rising cost of diesel fuel. Thank you both for taking time to talk to us about it.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
And if you want to get a jump start on our final story, go to here-now.org to see pictures of military secret patches. That's next, Here and Now.
The blood of this country flows along on 18 wheels. And it's a hell of a man.
Trevor Paglen has produced a book that shows what military secrecy looks like. It's, in one case, a round patch like a Boy Scout merit badge that says goat suckers above a picture of a plane. Another has a big question mark and a crescent moon, and it says, don't ask, N-O-Y-F-B, none of your... you get it. These are military patches, code for the world of the so-called black projects that inspired them. Black because they live in a void that can't be seen, a world that doesn't exist. The name of the book is embroidered on the real patch that's on the cover. It's, I could tell you, but then you would have to be destroyed by me, emblems from the Pentagon's black world. And author Trevor Paglen, who collected these patches, joins us from UC Berkeley in California. Trevor, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Robin.
Let's just get right to those two patches I mentioned. Goat suckers, the one with the cartoony airplane chasing a goat. What is that about?
That's a little bit of a historical patch. It's from a stealth fighter unit from the 1980s when that aircraft was still secret. The nickname of it is the Nighthawk. And at the time, that name was classified. And so one of the units called themselves the Goat Suckers. And the name Goat Sucker comes from the fact that the Nighthawk, the bird, is a member of the Goat Sucker family of birds. And so it's kind of an inside joke that they used to cryptically refer to the nickname of the secret aircraft they were flying.
Nobody was going to look at that patch on anyone's shoulder and say, aha, Nighthawk.
That's right.
The other one with the big question mark in the crescent moon that says, don't ask, N-O-Y-F-B, and we'll be delicate here. What's that?
That's also a little bit of a historical patch here. This is for cargo crews who flew classified aircraft from factories in Southern California to testing ranges in Nevada. This acronym N-O-Y-F-B often shows up in patches associated with black projects.
Right. None of your business, so to speak.
Right.
Well, military patches are hugely popular, and you point out that they have been since the Civil War?
The modern kind of system of unit insignia goes back to the Civil War so that generals could identify the officers under their command.
Right. There was a leader in the war who didn't understand which troops were his, so he told his troops, put a red piece of cloth on your cap, and it started from there. Well, and then these secret patches. We've heard about the secret prisons, for instance, of the CIA. But what is this? What is the Pentagon's so-called black world with its own black budget?
It's an interesting thing. If you go and you look at the defense budget, which you can download from the Department of Defense, you'll see that there are a lot of line items that just have code names associated with them, or line items that will say classified program and won't have a number associated with. When you add all these things up, you find between $30 and $40 billion that are simply missing. So this is the money that funds what people in the Defense Department call the black world, the world that doesn't exist.
Right. And yet, as you say, it burbles up on these patches. Let's go through a few more of the patches. And by the way, we'll have pictures on our website. But on page 35, a lifetime of silence behind the green door. And how would you describe the image in the center of the patch there?
Well, what we have is a character who shows up often in these patches. He's the Phantom. So he's a little guy with a big hat carrying a dagger and has red eyes. Mm. This kind of connotes intelligence activity, spying, this sort of thing. And we have a map of the world behind him, and we have a star in the southwest and another star in the sky. And this is a patch worn by units who are involved in satellite reconnaissance, people who control spy satellites from the ground.
And we understand they picked up the phrase green door from a 1956 hit song about a guy who couldn't get into a party that was going on behind a green door.
The image of the green door has a long history, and it kind of connotes an inaccessible place. There's also obviously a pornographic film by this title.
Well, there you go. Here's another patch. There's this sort of shadowy, cartoony figure peeking up above a trench coat, and the letters underneath say, NKAWTG, dot, 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 nobody.
This is another funny one. Again, we have this figure of the Phantom with red eyes. On this patch, he's carrying a tanker boom, which is a boom that if you are in an air refueling squadron, you put down into the airplane that you want to refuel. And NKAWTG is a phrase that's been long associated with refueling squadrons. It says, no one kicks arse without tanker gas. Nobody.
Nobody.
So this is a secret refueling squadron.
And on page 61 it would seem like the classic secret patch. It's just a round disc, a dark, dark color. On the top, the words, if I tell you. On the bottom, I have to kill you. That's it.
black, black, black. Everything's black. This is from a Navy squadron that was based at Point Magoo, California, called VX-4.
And this is just the generic patch for black projects that were designed for air test and evaluation by them.
That's right. Right. That's right.
Well, Trevor, a couple things. How do troops feel about their patches? What do their patches do for them?
I think a lot of units take a huge amount of pride in these patches. Yeah. There's a tradition in the military of having what's called Friday patches. And normally if you join a unit, the Air Force will issue you a patch for that unit. And oftentimes people don't like those very much, and so they'll make their own. And the tradition is that you're allowed to wear these on Fridays. So they tend to be much more colorful.
It's sort of the military's version of Casual Friday.
In the military's version of Casual Friday. But it also turns out that a lot of these black units are not under those normal chains of command, so they can come up with their own patches.
Well, but then they're not secret anymore. I mean, if you're wearing a patch that says, you know, NW whatever, I will kill you, you're not a secret.
That is true, but you have to keep in mind that these patches are generally not worn outside secure facilities at military bases.
Well, and you also met someone who, when you showed them this collection that you had, it turned him off. He said, yeah, to me, those are gang patches.
This is a very alienating world to live in for some people, this black world. This is a world you can't tell your family what you do for a living. You might not even be able to tell them where you work. And a lot of people get frustrated by that and don't enjoy that at all for understandable reasons. I think in the patches generally you see people venting a little bit about that. And there's a lot of people who trying to get out of this world don't enjoy it at all. And the guy who said they were gang signs was trying to get out of this world.
Oh. Well, and here you are collecting this world in this, it's kind of an attractive black book. And we understand that since it's come out, people have been sending you more.
Yeah, that's one of the nice things about doing a book like this is that you end up meeting a lot more people and people send you new stuff. It's very fun.
But you could also say that it's a reminder of how much is going on in the military, paid for by American taxpayers, and they don't know anything about.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it refers to. I mean, when you look at the book, you find that there's been a large number of airplanes that have been built that have never seen the light of day. I mean, this is a huge industry that's been going on for quite some time. I've gotten a lot of mail from people who, you know, will have an older brother or something like that that works in this world and can't talk about what they do. And a lot of people have gotten gifts of the book that from family members who work in this world but can't talk about it.
Yeah, I have a friend whose husband is a longtime secret person, and now maybe she could look at this and see, you know, what he's been doing.
It really is a world. When people talk about this black world, they'll say things like, I moved to the black world, as if it were someplace that one could go. And when you look at the scale of it, it is huge. It really is a world within a world.
Well, and you can peek into it, though, in Trevor Paglen's book. I could tell you, but then you would have to be destroyed by me. And don't forget, you can see the patches as well at our website, here-now.org. Trevor, now we have to destroy you, because you have told us. Or wait, now you're going to destroy us.
Thank you so much for having me, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.